Hey gang, are you in a band in Austin and you're looking to stop being the band of jerks and move up to the band that works? Well, you can start by rehearsing at Space. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. With 31 spacious rooms and wide gallery-lit corridors, plenty of parking, Space is the place for you to get your act together, all right? You can call them at 512-448-9518 or simply go to spaceatx.com and book yourself a room there, all right? Be the band that works, not the band of jerks. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a fantastic show for you guys today. This sounds a little different, this intro, because I'm coming to you from my hotel room in Houston. I'm here playing a show with Skyrocket. We're playing a gala fundraiser for Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And we did sound check a little earlier, and we had a couple hours to kill before the gig, so I came to my hotel and took a shower and decided to do this intro. Say hello to you guys. I've got a great show for you today. Jesse Sublett is back. He's got a new book that's out that is absolutely fantastic. It's called 1960s Austin Gangsters, Organized Crime That Rocked the Capitol. It is a fantastic, fantastic story about the Overton Gang and the organized crime scene in Austin. Brothels, madams, bank robberies, and UT football. What? All kinds of stuff, man. This is a great book. Jesse did a tremendous amount of research. You get his passion for research, and you get his passion for sort of these nefarious characters and like getting to know them and finding the humanity in them. He is a great writer, and this book is fantastic. I can't believe it hasn't been optioned for like a movie or like an HBO show yet. But anyway, I don't know if you know Jesse. Jesse was in the Skunks. He's been a long-time person on the music scene. He became a writer, wrote documentaries for the History Channel. He's written several books. His newest book, 1960s, Austin Gangsters, Organized Crime That Rocked the Capitol. You can find it at jessesublett.com. You can also find out more about it. There's a synopsis of the book. I dare you to read that synopsis and not want to read this book, okay? Jesse and I have a great conversation. It took a while to get it going. I ended up reading the book twice this summer, which was fine with me because it was really exciting and it's a great read. Highly recommended. Enjoy my conversation with Jesse coming up in just a second. Let me tell you what's going on with me. I played at the XTC tribute show last night at Strange Brew. It was fantastic. John Green, fantastic musician in Austin, he and his wife Sela put together this great group of musicians and all these fantastic singers, and they raised some money for Sims. It was great. It was a sellout show. I sang Kaleidoscope by Dukes of Stratosphere. Darren sang some songs. David Rice, Bruce Hughes, Miles Zuniga. It was fantastic, and I had a great time. So, look, I wish there was some video or some recording of that. If there is, I'll let you guys know, or if they're going to do something like that again. But I did have a great time doing it. I'm doing this podcast intro because we're doing three shows this week. So I'm putting this show out. It's Monday. There'll be another one out on Wednesday and another one out on Friday. Can't tell you what they are yet because they're very exciting, okay? I'm going to go to the Pecan Street Festival when I get back to Austin tomorrow. I'm going to go walk around, going to see some stuff, going to see some bands. Some friends of mine are playing tomorrow afternoon, and then I'm going to go to the party. My friend Back has a podcast called The Feedback Podcast, and he's having a party and a live podcast recording over at the Empire Control Room. So I'm going to have a great Sunday. Me and Zuri, we're going to head downtown. We can do it on foot. Walk around, have a great time, maybe have some cocktails, maybe have some funnel cake. Hey guys, you want to know about some nefarious characters in Austin, the organized crime scene in Austin, the 1960s? Check out my friend Jesse Sublett right now, all right? We have a great conversation about his book, 1960s Austin Gangsters, Organized Crime That Rocked the Capitol. Sit back and enjoy it. Here's my man, Jesse Sublett. Let's get down.
Cherish me, Marianne won't marry me till I'm dead. Betty Lou won't parlez-vous.
I split my time doing different things too, but some of these endeavors, like, you know, researching a book,
yeah,
that, like, I can't even begin to think how much research you did
for the Overton Gang. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy because it was pretty disorganized because I didn't approach it like a book from the beginning. I thought, well, this will make a movie.
HBO show. That was like, I have that written at the very. I mean, it would be great.
That was always the reaction people gave me when I first brought it up. I thought, have you heard about this aspect of Austin? Bank burglars that were football players and pimps and everything, and it was all happening. And,
well, and everyone's tied in from, like, Dick DeGaren to, yeah, like, you know, Charles Whitman.
Yeah.
To, you know, there was let me ask you real quick. There's a club, and I just wanted, Le Lollipop. Was that just right over here?
Yeah, exactly. That's the same.
I'm making the hair on my arms stand up.
I know, isn't it weird? I mean, I know people who live there, and I intend to go, you know, hang out there when they invite me. But, you know, yeah, and that was a new, you know, if you squint your eyes, you can look around and see how, you know, in the 60s, you know, what are really trashy apartments now were really swinging modern places. Yeah. And I know in the mid 70s, when I was playing in the band, we would play pool parties over in these apartments, and they were real swinging, you know, real, you know, it was real collegiate mostly.
Were they apartments that had kind of that LA setup where they were like in a U and then the pool was in the middle?
Yeah. And they were fitted onto the hillside, so in whichever way worked. But yeah, very much LA style. Yeah, oriented around the pool.
Right.
Yeah. So there was always a vibe that, yeah, this is an exciting place to live. Or maybe it's because I was young also. But
this book has been out since like March, right?
Yeah.
1960s Austin Gangsters, Organized Crime That Rocked the Capitol. So you were doing research for another book when you came across?
Yeah, I was working on my memoir, and I just stumbled across clippings that happened to be the very same week of something I was looking for. And then boom, you know, these headlines jumped out at me. And it was a whole thing that I didn't know about, you know, this underworld Austin that was tied into everything. And everything being the underworld gambling and after-hours clubs.
Drug smuggling.
Drug smuggling, prostitution, anything that was illegal, a lot of these guys would do rather than just work a day job. And you know, most of them were used car salesmen on the side, or the most serious of the burglars and strong-arm guys. They would at least have a card identifying themselves as auto sales. So when they got pulled over by a cop, I'd say, you have a job? Yeah, I'll sell cars. Because they did, because they collected Cadillacs and stuff, just like chunky gold jewelry and expensive watches, because when you got busted and you needed a lawyer or bail money, you know, you hawked that.
You have it right there, yeah.
Yeah. So that was their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And after a while, you know, you sympathize with them because, a little bit at least, no matter how terrible they were, because a lot of times they were persecuted or prosecuted because of their lifestyle. You know, the cops would say, this guy's a character, and that's what they call them. They were characters.
Right.
So therefore, they could, you know, arrest them and hold them in jail and beat them up.
Right.
And so
there's a thing that you say, that the last thing I'd want to do is romanticize them, but they were interesting people living during an interesting time. Many, if not all, of the men came from dysfunctional backgrounds and the kind of circumstances that tend to foster feelings of powerlessness and low self-esteem. And in a perverted way, learning to control others through intimidation and violence might have felt like a personal advancement.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt obligated to
it's
write
a lot
that.
Of sympathy.
Yeah.
You know, empathy.
Yeah, I felt obligated to write that because as soon as you hear that guys got over on the system and that they were having a swinging time, that they broke into banks. Who likes banks? You know, you see a bank, you go, yeah, screw them. You know, they're cold-hearted institution bastards. But then you go, well, the people who do that kind of thing, they may, you know, beat their wife occasionally. They may, you know, just intimidate people in a power game. And so really you don't want to make heroes out of them. But, you know,
There's a story there that's fascinating.
Yeah, what you are romanticizing is the fact that these people did larger than life things, and they did things that other people fantasize about every day. I mean, you know, I don't go around saying, I'm going to kill this guy because he cut in front of me. Some people do, and they don't mean it, of course.
Of course, you know? Yeah.
Or I'm going to blow up, you know, that place that ripped me off. You know, you're not going to do that, but you talk about it. So,
yeah.
Therefore, when you read about guys who lack that thing that holds you back,
yeah,
you know, it's interesting.
The guys that got kicked off the football team and Daryl Royal turned their back on them, so they go, yeah, and like mess up and rob the co-op.
Yeah. Well, you know, Daryl Royal was just like a saint around here.
Yeah.
And he wasn't the nicest guy. He was a coach, for Christ's sakes. And, you know, he came from a screwed up background, too. And so he pulled power trips with people all the time. And a lot of people got, you know, abused by that system of the athletic, whatever, you know, their ethics, you know, that they operate by. And that's fine. But, I love the fact that they wanted to get even with Daryl Royal, and they did.
Yeah.
Cracks me up.
Yeah.
Yeah. As I write about, one of the crucial things was they burglarized the UT co-op very cleverly of the Thanksgiving Day UT A&M football game. That's when the co-op sold most of the tickets out of there,
yeah,
and students could go there and cash checks. So they had lots and lots of cash in their safe.
Yeah.
And so when everybody was roasting their turkey and getting ready, yeah, to watch the big game, and all the cops were out on the streets directing traffic, because Austin was really a small town then. And so when they had, like, I think 19,000 people come to town for a game, that was a big, big deal. So everybody was concentrating on that. And in the early morning hours of that day, these guys were working on that safe. It took a while to peel it. They had to attack it with the grinding machines and torches and stuff to finally get it open. But they busted it open and got all the money out.
I mean, there's a chemical that they use to in the torches that I imagine was very hard to come across.
Well,
at that time, or was it not?
No, it wasn't, because of all the a lot of these guys tried working in the oil patch for a while,
mm-hmm,
decided it was too rough. They'd rather gamble or steal. And so they had experiences with those torches and with other big tools that they used on the pipelines.
Uh-huh. There
was a lot of work on the pipelines at,
okay,
that time. So a lot of these guys came from the oil field with that experience. And there was a lot of steel work here in town at that time. So a lot of the guys had done erecting building steel work here. And of course, Timmy Overton and his family had a transmission shop, so they had all kinds of tools.
Right.
So the big, most powerful torch you might be referring to is the magnesium.
Yeah,
They call it,
There's a picture of it even where you can just see it's a pretty intense,
yeah,
burn. It must come out of,
yeah,
out
it just
high.
Like explodes.
Yeah.
When it hits concrete, the concrete just explodes.
Yeah.
And so, it was a tube packed with magnesium rods. Sometimes they called it a burning rod, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, burning bar, that's right. Just a big tube full of magnesium feed it with the oxygen, and the thing was just over 7,000 degrees. But the problem with that was, like, you get a small safe, money safe, and it's really hard to keep keep it cool enough for the, you know, not to burn the money up inside before you get a hole in there.
Right.
So they would run gas, water hoses from the bathroom to the safe and cool it down and cool. And as soon as they got a hole, they would run the water inside, and it would make a hell of a mess.
Yeah.
Besides all the sparks and the ashes and these bankers, when they'd come in, they'd find their bank all really trashed.
And that's what those places had, like, alarms at that time, didn't they?
Well, but they might, like, have an alarm. Not,
but it's just like ding, 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 ding.
Right.
Yeah.
And these guys could, these guys were good at defeating alarm systems.
Yeah.
Which weren't that sophisticated. They were also, they might have an alarm that just rings down at the, I don't know where the alarms would ring if they didn't just ring on the place. Some of them would ring at the police station, but the main places these guys hit were small towns of 2,000 and under, where they didn't have a police force in the town. They used a night watchman, or would call the sheriff's office, which was usually miles away.
Right.
So, it was basic, brute strength, most of their work.
Yeah, they kind of had a touring route,
yeah,
almost. You know, like, people would go out and tour like that.
Yeah,
with their band. This is what these guys did.
Exactly. Yeah. They put on a lot of miles, a lot of West Texas and up around. You know, it also duplicated a lot of the travels of Bonnie and Clyde. They would go in that Midwest circuit. They would go up into northern and West Texas, and then head up around the towns that were around the state lines.
Uh-huh.
So if they did something in one
across
town,
the state line.
Yeah, they'd jump across the state line, and the police couldn't chase them that way. So these guys hit a lot of those same towns, and a lot of that same resentment against any kind of authority, not just federal government, which people have a thing about now, but any kind of government. There was holdover attitudes from the Depression.
Yeah.
Like, we got screwed. You know, what do I care if the bank gets ripped off? And a lot of people that just sort of, they lived off the land, and they, a lot of those guys didn't really have that much of a problem with outlaws, as long as they didn't bother them.
What kind of drugs were they smuggling then?
Like, well, they did a lot of pot. There was Hispanics and ex-cons and beatniks were smoking pot in Austin back in the 50s. I guess in the 40s, too. I don't know that much about the 40s. But in the 50s, they were doing it, and, it sort of crossed over into white, you know, college student culture in the 50s. And not that these guys were doing it that I know of, but peyote buttons were like 50 cents a piece or less at some nurseries here in the late 50s and early 60s. And but they did speed. Timmy Overton, when he was going to college, he was a good source of uppers. When you needed to study for an exam.
And back then, those were like Benzedrine and pills and stuff.
It wasn't
like meth.
Yeah, Benzedrine and something. I guess Dexys. I forget the names. But they were also, people just called them diet pills, and everybody was really taking them, just about. So there wasn't a big stigma about it. But these guys did know it was good for partying.
Yeah. Yeah, you could keep the party going for as long as you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. So, these guys, Tim Overton started kind of his life of crime at Austin High, when he was at Austin High. And that's when a guy like Dick DeGaren was running with him. I met that guy a few times when I was a kid. My mom, a friend of my mom's, is married to him.
Really?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Janie.
Oh, ah.
So, yeah. And I grew up with her kids.
Wow.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, Dick...
Did you know him previous to this?
No, I didn't. I mean, and so I contacted him through, after getting referred by a good friend of his. Said, call Dick, he'll talk to you. And so I did, and he responded right away with a great program. He said, my last class at UT of the summer is on Friday, and he teaches some kind of law, criminal law class there. and come to the come sit in on the lecture, and then we'll go eat. And so, huge class, you know, several hundred in the auditorium and auditorium style classroom, and Nick was on fire. I mean, you know, just like an evangelist or whatever, and showed videos of the initial arrest of some of his clients that sounded like no hope cases. You'd get the evidence and say, well, this guy's going to jail for a long time.
It's usually what you think when you see a guy that he's defending.
And so Dick would explain how, you know, how he got them off. And several things stood out for me that he said to the class. He said, you are the elite. Never forget, you are the elite. Defending people who do terrible things is an honorable profession. And it just gave me goosebumps. So it kind of turned around my image of like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. You know, everybody's entitled to constitutional protection, you know, no matter
what. That's the way our thing is set up, yeah.
That's the way it is.
Yeah.
So that was good. And then we went to Wero's, and there was a ranger, a Texas ranger, that was part of his lecture series that summer. I forgot his name, but we went to lunch at Wero's, and he just, you know, talked and talked and talked and dropped names and told me who to call and told me what it was like. Basically, it was started out just like the juvenile delinquent movies you see from the 50s, guys having a good time going out in their cars and racing and necking and, you know, and maybe going to a speakeasy. And then some of them get, there's fights, you know. Yeah. It's like the top gunfighter type deal, you know, who's the toughest guy in school.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And then it goes a few notches darker, and some guys peel away and some guys stick with it. And these guys stuck with it. But something triggered, there were definitely dark things going on in the Overton household. I didn't get, I wouldn't want to say what I think without proof, but I think it was a rough, those kids had a rough time. Five boys, and the mother and father were always on the verge of being homeless practically. They moved all the time, even though they had the family business. And so.
But the dad didn't have any illegal.
Not really. I mean.
Not overt.
Nothing that sent him to the pen that we know of.
But basically, yeah. Also, what you're saying is like on that side of town, the East First area.
Yeah.
That just, everything was a little shady.
Yeah. And you know, there were, it's not to indict everybody who lived there, because a lot of honest people who lived there, you know, it was just like a kind of a working class to marginal existence. So, you know, you had regular families on the street, you know, and then you'd have the bad family, you know, at on the corner or whatever, you know. There were fences over there, you know, people who buy hot merchandise. There was a lot of stuff going on. And so a lot of people there fell through the cracks. And Hispanics there got treated terribly by the police. You know, they were definitely second-class citizens. And
it's interesting in the there's that thing where if you're going to get in trouble and then you get caught up in the system of being in trouble, sometimes it's literally just like a circle.
Yeah,
you can't
marked.
Get out of it.
Yeah, you can't get out of it. As soon as these guys got out of the pen, the cops would tail him. They'd go, okay, he's the next con. We know he's going to screw up. Yeah. So we'll bounce him as soon as he does.
Yeah.
You know? So, or make an informant. So you couldn't win, really.
Right. And so then there was a bigger syndicate, the Dixie Mafia.
Yeah. So these guys kind of fed into that. That thing was developing as the Overton gang were doing their thing. There were guys in Biloxi, Mississippi, especially the sort of redneck Riviera there, not far from New Orleans, and they had, gambling was illegal, but but there was lots of gambling casinos on that strip. And so these guys did everything. And the guys who owned those casinos, they were mafia. They were mafia and everything but the, you know, name.
Actual. Okay, know. So yeah. But they weren't connected to, like, people in New York, but maybe to sort of the mob that was in Dallas and Kansas City?
A lot of them did business with Carlos Marcello. Okay. I mean, they knew Carlos Marcello, the little man in New Orleans. Right. There was some kind of interaction with him. I can't say. Well, and sometimes it was a bad interaction. A couple of these guys associated with the casino I mentioned in the book, I forgot, Red Carpet, they made the mistake of conning Carlos's brother out of $90,000, and all three of them ended up in painful deaths.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. A lot of that was going on, and so, like, it became like a network. Like, these guys might go up there and check things out and recruit some guys to do some jobs, do some burglaries, rob some gambling games, or and some of the casinos, they might need robbing. They might be in debt to somebody like Carlos or smaller, and they got robbed. I can't pay you, you know.
Yeah.
But they get killed anyway half the time. So it was really rough. They were the Dixie Mafia, which really came into its own in the early 70s. They were more violent and more out of control than the Italian Mafia ever was. They had a high body count.
Wow.
Yeah. And gradually that just sort of mostly became about drugs. And that's not where the Overton gang was. They did some drug smuggling, but they were mostly into the rackets.
Pimping.
And breaking into banks.
Bank robbing, yeah.
Yeah. So
the rackets.
Yeah. So that was more sustainable. You know, like in Austin, they were very, they partied a lot. So they were always getting stopped for being drunk or having their running prostitutes and stuff.
Right.
But rarely anything serious. Timmy's younger brother was a dope fiend, and he was always breaking into drugstores because they had money and dope. So he got arrested all the time for that. But Timmy and the guys, they didn't break into banks and stuff here. They maintained their rackets here, and then they would go out of town to do their serious stuff.
Yeah.
And they knew Jack Ruby and the Campeses and all those guys. And that led to I don't want to say credible, but several degrees of shady credibility that they knew something about the
Kennedy.
Kennedy assassination, if you believe in those types of mob-related conspiracies. If you believe in those types of conspiracies, it's conceivable that these guys knew what was happening, knew the guys who were involved in it.
Right.
Because they knew they were friends with Charles Harrelson and R.D., the infamous R.D. Matthews, the biggest thug in Dallas for several generations.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so were all those, I mean, because the Kennedy thing, not to go off on it, but the Kennedy thing stems from, they needed a Teamster vote, so Joseph went to Sam Giancana, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, boy.
Asked for his help, and then when Kennedy went into office and made his brother attorney general, he went after those dudes.
Yeah, it's really strange that the Kennedys, like, courted these guys, and then
they really did. It was like a total...
I'm a rattlesnake now. I was a bunny rabbit, but now I'm a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really weird of the Kennedys. I got to say. But yeah, that and so then after that, you know, they were bete noire with each other. So, like, I mean, really, I mean, Carlos Marcello certainly wanted JFK dead. Whether he lifted a hand to make it happen, I don't know. I tend to not believe the conspiracies. But a lot of that stuff's fun because once you look at it, you see, yeah, all those connections are really interesting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they're there.
Yeah.
You know? It's kind of hard to deny it when you're like, well, these guys go and fuck people up when they do them wrong.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they do it with the president?
Yeah, right.
Find some patsy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, all that's interesting. And Dallas was such a toxic place. That's another reason.
A lot of mafia in Dallas.
Yeah,
right?
And those ultra-conservative maniacs, Howard Hunt, for one, H.L. Hunt.
Right.
I'm not sure what his first name was, but what I recently found out about him, and Hunt was the guy who financed a lot of the super ultra-right-wing hate machine propaganda against Kennedy and against the U.N. and everything. And I mean, the Tea Party ought to worship this guy, but he financed a lot of that stuff and was putting out all kinds of toxic vibes. He was also a big health food and supplement guy.
Oh, wow.
And he, if I remember correctly, popularized avocados. At one point, he invited these reporters to his mansion, had a huge mansion, which I believe was modeled after Mount Vernon, and was talking about his theories of health and long life, and showed them, this is what I do to keep my body in shape. It's going to keep me living, you know, way past 100. And he was crawling around the room on all fours with these reporters, and they were pretty freaked out, you know, this billionaire crawling around.
That's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was the Dallas Police Department corrupt like the Austin one was?
I think so. Yeah, yeah. Very much so.
So I bet when you came across that, when you research, you were like, what? They had the cells bugged? And
yeah. 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 It's funny because these guys, the Austin Police and the DPS, they're very, I don't know, they act like they're very straight arrow, but you know, they were very willing to resort to quasi-legal methods of surveillance, and you know, it was just a more brutal time. It was before, one thing that's important to think about is that this stuff, this 1960s crime stuff, was before Miranda.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Miranda wasn't until 1968, after 68.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So, like, when you arrested somebody, they were your little plaything, you know?
You could do a bar of soap and a sock and get some info from him.
Yeah.
Come back out on the street, and there's no recourse for him to come back and get you.
Yeah, and the Texas Rangers could be really brutal. They would drive you around from jail to jail, you know, and you couldn't be found, and they'd beat you up in one small town jail and then take you to another one, and, you know, eventually.
Wow.
You'd tell them whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the surveillance was really interesting to me because the Overtons suspected that their places were bugged, and so they were pretty careful, but things slipped. And when Timmy Overton found a bug in his wall heater vent,
right,
he flipped out and got really mad. And one of his lawyers was anxious to do something big, and he filed a federal suit against APD in Austin and anyone else that could be found to be associated with planting these bugs. And so as soon as they did that, it was revealed that the county courthouse and jail were wired. They had a recording system studio in the basement, and they were listening in on prisoners talking to their lawyers and all kinds of stuff. And the sheriff was just a classic good old boy type, was saying, yeah, there's no such thing as the bugs in here. Okay, we have this recording equipment, but we don't even know how to use it.
Right,
you know, just
right.
Really lame excuses. And so, but that really wasn't that huge of a scandal. I mean, it made headlines, but as far as I could tell, nobody lost their job over it. So.
And then it took years for them to remove that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to have seen more on that, you know, seen, I mean, that stuff, I mean, that must have been really cool equipment.
Yeah.
He'd want some of those tube mic amps and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet it was really cool equipment. Yeah,
giant knobs. And,
it seems almost like in that police department and the law enforcement is another book in itself.
Yeah. Yeah, there's... This has been the most fun. I mean, for many years, I was sort of ashamed that I had, it took me so long to try to figure out how to get this book out. And I kept putting it in the closet and saying, well, it's a waste of time. And finally, last year, History Press told me they were interested. And so I figured out a way to make a 175-page narrative out of it. You know, I picked and chose the material I thought would work in that format. And they got it out. And it's been pretty good, right? It's not like being on Knopf or Little Brown, but and it's really micro-targeted toward Austin. But the feedback has been really, really great. People come to me all the time, so grateful that I've recaptured this history for them. It's part of their they own it, you know. So many of Timmy Overton's classmates. They love that time period, and even though there's really not that much high school in the book, they just love the fact that this is part of their past, and it's been preserved for them, and people who knew them on both sides of the law, and people who are related to people in the book, it's just been really rewarding in a way that I've never experienced before as a writer.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously, I'm not the only person that's like, hey, so you're going to do a screenplay? Can you get this?
Yeah.
It's
got to be a movie. It's really got to be a movie or a long-form series. Yeah. It's got to be. Anybody listening, we're considering offers. I've had a couple of offers that we're talking about. Everybody writes a book or even, they go, man, this will make a great movie. But, you know, so I have to bear that in mind. But, damn, this is Austin. Austin's supposed to be really hot. And in so many ways, this is a classic Austin story because it's got slackers in it, but it's also not what you'd expect. It's like these, at the time period when things were going Paisley and Dayglow and hippified, these guys are going the other direction. They're going Frank Sinatra and Vegas and Luna, hey, baby, with their Cadillacs and pompadours. So it's not what people expect. It's just weird and cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I didn't, for some reason, I didn't know about it until one day I was just sitting down to eat some lunch and I turned on the TV and there you were on the on a morning show talking about it.
That was really fun. I did not think that mentioning skunk tattoos on her butt Timmy's girlfriend was going to be a big deal. But my co-host... I saw her face just like it flashed all these colors. Yeah. It was really interesting. I mean, she didn't move, but like, I thought, whoa, wow, okay. I would have, I don't know. I was, I'm pretty, I censor myself. But I didn't think that was going to be a deal.
But it was.
Yeah.
Are you, outside of that, like, are there, the prostitution thing was pretty, eye-opening.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird because, it's hard to talk about without, you want to be careful because you don't want to sound like a cad. It's awful. It's, most of these girls came to it from desperation.
Yeah.
Or just sheer lack of self-esteem, and they were sort of, enchanted into doing it because pimps have a powerful rap. They know they're like heat-seeking missiles. They can go in, home in on a girl who's in a situation and just wrap them around their finger. So that's sad and awful. But for some of these girls, they thought, well, hell, that sounds like fun. And some of them emerged from it intact. Ones I talked to, some of them did. And they don't seem to regret it. And so you don't want to put them down, for the choice they made, that things worked out okay.
Right.
I mean, they aided and abetted some bad people sometimes, but, you know, I guess we all do. But, so there's that, and then there's the fact that, man, you know, you don't want to romanticize it, because some of these people were really brutal, and they were brutal because, for the most part, I'm pretty sure they were brutalized when they were young, yeah. So...
I don't think that you romanticize it. I just think that when you get into something, it's fascinating. I mean, look at how, I don't know, did you see the Jinx? Like, speaking of Dick DeGaren, that thing about Robert Durst.
Oh, man, I haven't yet. It's on my list. Yeah, I want to see that.
But,
yeah.
Like, you know, you can't turn away from that. And that's an awful person, probably.
Yeah.
Or at least what, allegedly.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, it's so weird. I mean, how many times do you meet people who, I don't know, just people are human, and a lot of bad people are, you know, there's that 5% of them that's really evil, and then when you're around them, and they seem okay.
Well, you know, another guy in your book that my mom knew and was friends with, he's always such a character to me. I don't know him well or anything, but I did run into him a few years ago in an elevator, and I was like, are you Giorgio Jackson?
Oh,
and he was like, I was like, you probably don't remember me, but my mom was, now that you remembered her, but I was like, and he's in it, and he's, I just kind of remember him, he's a character.
He is a character.
I mean, do you
character.
Know him well? Did you meet him through the book, or did you
I
know
met
him before?
I met him through the book, I met him before
friends, right?
Dick,
I think that's how
I met him before I talked to Dick. He's the one who said, call Dick right now, and so I can't remember who told me to call George, but George is worth his weight in solid gold. I just talked to him a few times, and then spent an evening at his apartment in the Westgate with his Bengal kittens running around. And he had a lot of his photos. As you know, he's an esteemed photographer.
You know what? I didn't know what he did. I mean, he was like an adult when I was like, 13 or something. Right. And while I found him entertaining and stuff, I didn't hang out with him, and I didn't really know what he did.
He's the kind of guy who can tell stories and you go, like, well, this guy is a fantasist. None of this could be true. Yeah, when I was hanging out with John Huston, and,
that was fascinating.
I met John Huston through Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Puerto Vallarta, and what?
It's funny,
because all true.
I remember, I have one distinct memory of him, and it was being in a car going somewhere with my mom, and he was going on about this lady that they had met at a party the night before. And he kept on going, like, you don't know who she is? She's the last chick that slept with Jack Kennedy before he was assassinated, like the night before. And all this stuff that was just like, whoa.
Yeah, I mean,
But that's my only memory of him, is hearing a story. Like, so when he comes up in your book and starts telling that John Huston stuff, you're like, yeah. This guy's just a character.
He really is. I mean, I've looked for. I wish I could see pictures of him when he was in his 20s and 30s, because I look pretty good now. You can imagine this blonde guy, got plenty of money, great personality. You know, so everybody wants to hang around with him.
Yeah.
You know, so you can put him on in all these bizarre situations, and there's no end to it.
Yeah.
But he gave me, he introduced me to a lot of the strange kind of dissonance of the story. Me talking about hanging around with Jerry Ray James and Timmy and partying and having a good time, and then mentioned something really terrible that they did that he was never a party of. He just heard about. And so he would say, they're really fun to hang around with. There was really something wrong with all of them, though. So.
Well, he ended up flying Tim to Mexico.
Yeah. He flew.
He had a plane.
Yeah. He had a share of a, I forgot what plane, some kind of Cessna.
Yeah.
So he was flying to Puerto Vallarta a lot, and so he flew them over there at least once. The FBI was under the impression that he flew those guys and some other guys around a lot. I didn't discuss that with George, and I probably won't, but they really want George to testify at the big conspiracy trial. And he went out there on the subpoena, and the prosecuting attorney took him aside before his testimony and showed him the things, talking points he wanted him to talk about. And George started crossing things out and saying, I'm not going to say that. That's not true. Blah, blah, blah. And they had a big fight, and George ended up not testifying at all. But the FBI was real interested in George, not because of anything he did other than being with these guys and possibly flying them places where they did things.
Right. Yeah, I bet he's got some books in him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So when you, how long did you say you spent doing research for this? Because this is just an immense amount.
Off and on, over 10 years.
Because
I started in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
I would work on it for a while, and I even produced a couple of rough drafts, and rough drafts that were mostly no good. And since there was no pay involved, I would have to put it aside and do things that I did get paid for.
Right.
So sometimes many months would pass by before I even looked at my files. So, yeah.
What has anybody from the city proper given you some feedback?
City
like
proper.
You know what I mean? Like, this could be a cool thing to have. I mean, I realize like it's not in the brochure like you say.
Yeah.
But it could be something they could sell at the Austin, you know. Hey, check it out.
I agree. It's passed. They should have it at the convention center and everything.
Yeah.
Maybe they will. I should talk to them about that. I was pleased when I heard that one of the guys who sent me an offer to option the book, I bought it at the airport. I was thrilled to know that it was at the airport. I haven't had a chance.
Oh, yeah,
I
saw it at the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love being at the airport and Walgreens. And so, no official contacts from the city yet.
Because it's, it's just fascinating. I'm trying to see what else.
And
then also, they're explain the connection to the Judge John H. Wood Jr., which is the guy that Woody Harrelson's dad.
Yeah. That's one of those things where you keep going,
it's just
tracing these guys. There's no end to it.
Yeah.
But the guy, little Larry Culbreth, who assassinated Timmy Overton, kept on doing stuff. And so he was hanging out with Charles Harrelson when he was casing the assassination of federal judge John Wood.
Right.
And the next day, FBI pulled him over, and he was driving Harrelson's car, and they wanted to talk to him about a number of things. And that's a guy who, you know, was heavy into stuff.
Yeah. It's funny because all these guys were very, very law savvy.
Yeah.
They lawyered up when they had to. They knew the parameters where they could do their stuff and not get caught because
they didn't go anywhere without having a lawyer to call in that town. When they would get stopped and searched, you know, they would have all these lawyers' cards on them and stuff, and so they wouldn't say anything.
Well, it's definitely organized crime.
Yeah,
I mean, they were organized.
Yeah,
yeah,
and sometimes they were just they seemed out of control sometimes.
Yeah.
They partied a lot and did a lot of stupid things. Regarding the city, I do have a gig at the Austin History Center on September 20th, which is Sunday, Museum Day in Austin. So,
oh, no way.
And I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, the time is 2 o'clock. I was trying to remember. So I'll do a presentation. I'm going to actually do a slideshow, play a few songs.
Austin History Museum?
Center. Which is in the old building next to the downtown library.
Okay.
Yeah. So they've been good to me. I got a lot of my research there, so I'm happy to do a gig for them.
It's fascinating.
And doing the Dallas History for the Dallas Historical Society also.
Which, that's great.
Be fun. Yeah. They're having me.
And you have it. When is your? You don't know yet when your EP is going to come out, but it's going to come out.
I would
this
say,
fall?
Yeah, in the fall. Yeah.
Okay.
A month or two. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And you've been working on that for a while as well.
Yeah, I started last summer. You know, song at a time. I just like when there was time to go in and get the guys together and do a song, we'd do that, and then a few weeks later do another. And so I've got 7 now.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So do these, and I'll be playing a couple of songs from it on the show.
Yeah.
So people will hear them. And
I played a lot of acoustic bass on it. It's most of the bass on there is upright, which I really love to do. And it's really my first. Well, I've recorded a few songs with John D on acoustic bass, but
I saw you guys
I'm not
play
sure
together.
If they came out.
Did you play it together the other night?
At the gallery?
Yeah.
You were there?
No, I saw some pictures.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a great time.
Yeah.
We have a good rapport. We have a good rapport.
He's such a great guy.
Yeah.
I really love him a lot.
Yeah, he's deep. Yeah. He's deep. I all the time I say, like, he's the most literate person I know, and he doesn't write books or anything, you know?
No, but I bet he could.
He could.
Let me ask you, in your songwriting, do any of these, like, are your songs like more personal, or do you sometimes have like character studies? You know what I mean?
Yeah, both. Yeah, yeah. A lot of my stuff is just a character that evolves from lyrics. You know, I really like the picaresque, the not so great guy. Narrator, the unreliable narrator of a song, so a person who's wrapped up in their own tragedy and they don't even see it, or they're just, you know, not that great. So I do a lot of character songs. I do some that are personal, but they're wrapped up in, you know, lyrical stuff that they're not, like, you know, identifiable necessarily.
Right.
One of my best songs on the EP is the slowest and most kind of dramatic. It's called Stones in the Coffin. Mm-hmm. I might have played that, given you a demo of that before, but it's a disaster song. It's about the title came from I read a story about a disaster in a third world country. It was really awful. I can't even remember what it was. I think it was a terrible earthquake, and a woman was saying that her brother, they had to put stones in the coffin because there was hardly anything left to bury. And I thought, Stones in the Coffin is a good title.
It's a great title.
So, yeah, so it's got a little bit of war in there and a little bit of it's got a verse about the 1953 tornado in Waco that... Category 5. They had a swarm of Category 5 tornadoes in the May of 1953 and in Texas. So anyway, so that's a good song. I'll brag about that one.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question. What do you read for fun?
I've been rereading Tom Jones, T-H-O-M Jones. He's a literary short story writer. I don't think he's written any novels. He's probably best known for Sonny Liston Was a Friend of Mine. That's the title story in one collection. And another one's called Pugilist at Rest. He's a Vietnam vet and a boxer who had terrible head injuries. So he's written a number of stories about, you know, having epilepsy from head injuries from boxing that are really good. But I'm rereading his stuff. And I just discovered a great graphic novelist named Tim Lane. And this guy is phenomenal. His material is real noir and beat. It's, well, half the stories are about guys in 60s lead sleds who go out on the road looking for something. They're not sure what, and they get in trouble. You know, his artwork is just phenomenal. he can do darkness better than anybody I can think of. His work is phenomenal. He's got two big collections of short stories, and so I just discovered him. I love him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People can find everything they need about you at jessesublett.com.
Yeah.
It's a good website.
Certainly.
Yeah. Solid. You can get this book physically at the airport. Book People, probably in Austin.
Yeah, Book People is so good to me. They support me really well.
And anywhere in the world on your Kindle, that's how I got it.
Yeah.
I Kindled it.
Amazon sells, Amazon will sell your stuff. I mean, they don't give you a lot in return, but in desperation, you can always go there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, is there anything that you're working on? You're helping Eddie with his book?
Yeah, a real exciting summer I've had working with Eddie Wilson, finishing his memoir, which he's been working on for years, too. Guy's a great storyteller, very historic person. Founded the Armadillo, ran it for most of its duration, and that really changed Austin, put Austin on the map. And so Eddie's a great guy and a good writer, and so his book just needed some shaping and ending. And so it's been in parts for years, and he kind of got disgusted and didn't want to touch it anymore. I said, let's get this book out. So I've told him we're going to get it out, and so it's going to get out. I think he's going to self-publish it. Really, the hard part, now that we've got and it needed a lot of like citations and stuff like that someone who's done historical stuff can do, and like something that somebody like Eddie doesn't really have time for.
Right.
He's running several restaurants and all kinds of stuff. So that's another thing I'm bringing to it. But the photos and posters, that's going to be tough, deciding what to leave out. You know, you get over 100 pictures in a book, and it's kind of out of control if you've also got a heavy text.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a hell of a book.
Yeah, it's going to be thick and rich with his. I've been watching, I haven't been watching, but a few months ago I went into like this YouTube wormhole for hours, probably a whole afternoon, because there's videos. They used to video the shows there.
Yeah.
A lot of the shows, and you can really see a lot of them.
It's amazing. I didn't realize how many shows there were videoed and that were
and it's
preserved.
More than one camera.
And there's more. Yeah, yeah. Eddie's Bobby Henderson, who was at the Armadillo just as long as Eddie, minus about 2 weeks, because they quit the same day also. Bobby Henderson is curating videos that they have. And there might be a documentary. Some of that's in the works right now. So a lot of that stuff is coming to a head now. It's really important, I think, because Austin has changed so much. And I don't want to live in the past, but it's neat to know what put us on the map and where things used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it would be, for me, like... the gangster book would be fascinating to read if you're moving to a place that's new.
Yeah.
And it's just like this sunshiny music festival place. And you're like, yeah, well, actually,
That
place you're having tacos at used to be a whorehouse.
Yeah, and I put the addresses in almost as many places as I could.
Yeah, I like that about it.
One critic criticized that. They said, oh, that's kind of a small town, isn't it? But no, the people want to know where stuff was.
Sure.
Todd Wolfson has been going on a gangster tour ever since it came out.
Oh, really?
He goes and checks by all the places. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was saying that to me a while back when I first got the book. I was most fascinated with that lollipop place because I was like,
yeah,
I could
have
walked
right
there.
You're right down the street from Austin's first go-go club where a lot of stuff happened, where I think
13th floor elevators played.
Timmy Overton had to have run into Rocky Erickson, whether it was just like they bumped into each other or they had a conversation. I don't know. I like to think about it, but I love the convergence of those cultures. And Hattie Valdez, the Austin's leading madam for decades, she would go there.
Yeah.
So it's also fun to like picture that, like you have go-go dancers and those funky little lights that they used back then and like young hipsters, and then you have these other people.
These guys kind of out of Goodfellas.
Yeah. and Hattie being like...
the guy playing electric jug on stage.
Yeah. Hattie looked like... There's no pictures of Hattie.
No.
But, and I only found them after the book came out, but she looked like an old school mom or like the grandma next door. She wore cat's eye glasses and mink coats. But she didn't, you wouldn't have thought, oh, there's, you know, the flamboyant Hattie Valdez. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And they were all kind of like famous from the paper. They kind of had like this rock star.
Yeah. That's the other thing that interests me. You know, these guys were going around town in their Cadillacs. Everybody knew what they were doing. But it was like, well, that's our environment.
They were really, it's funny, it's interesting because there is that sort of split, not to use De Guerin as a guy, but like he's a guy that at the beginning was there with Timmy, and they both went like in complete opposite directions. And then you wonder if like knowing those guys is something that informed Dick De Guerin to pursue the law that he practices.
Absolutely did. He empathizes. Yeah, he totally empathizes with the outlaw. He totally does. I mean...
You see that with stuff with him in interviews. I remember seeing like a 2020 or something when the Branch Davidian compound was attacked. He was the lawyer for Koresh, and just seeing him. I remember he broke down, like he couldn't finish a sentence just because there were so many kids in there and all that shit. And he had been in there and seen what was going on. It wasn't what the ATF was talking about. You know, anyway.
Yeah, you know, I didn't live here then, and so I didn't follow that as closely as I could have, although it was, oddly enough, I visited here. I just came to town the week it started. So I collected the newspapers. I thought, well, I'll read about all this later.
Yeah.
Because I was going around, you know, meeting people I hadn't seen in a while, and, stuff, and so I didn't really follow it. And so what you're telling me, I don't remember knowing.
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny because, like, the story of Dick, so, like, Dick represented the woman who ran over her husband repeatedly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and her navigator. You think, well, she needs to go to prison, you know, come on, you know, how can you even work with somebody like that? But have you ever seen an opera, you know, about a woman who's done wrong and so there's that.
You want to see her run over the husband by the end of the opera. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
You want to hear her story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, everybody in the system that we have set up, they have to be defended.
Right.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming. Is there anything that I'm missing?
I don't know, man. I appreciate you having me. I really do.
Dude, when I saw you do that, I got the book and then I went to New York or something for the to do a show. I read that book in one, basically on the plane ride up there and when I got to my hotel.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
You know, you love hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a page turner. It really is. Like, it's fascinating. It's exciting. And you aren't glorifying them or
good.
You know, but it's an interesting story worth telling. So everyone get out there and pick up 1960s Austin Gangsters, Organized Crime That Rocked the Capitol by the great Jesse Sublett. And you can find out all about him and about the book at jessesublett.com.
Yeah. Thanks, right. Bro.
Thank you, man.
All right.
Baby, don't marry me. Don't marry me till I'm dead.
Jesse Sublett. With his fantastic book, 1960s Austin Gangsters, Organized Crime That Rocked the Capital City. Great book. So great. Read it twice. See, we were supposed to do this interview like 6 weeks ago. So I read it on a trip to New York the week before. And then we had to postpone it for a while. And then I read it again. So anyway, great to have Jesse back in. And that music that you heard is from his upcoming EP, which I'm excited for you guys to hear. I got a copy of it and it's fantastic. So you can find out when it's coming out by going to jessesublett.com. And find out what's going on with his website's really good. And if you don't know if you're quite into the 1960s Austin Gangsters book, you can go there and just read. There's a summary of it that'll kind of get your beak wet, and you'll be like, hey, I want to get a little more of this. All right, I want to thank Jesse for coming by. Always great to sit down and talk to him. The guy's amazing and so cool. He is really so cool. I always enjoy sitting down and talking to him. Thank you, Jesse. Everyone out there, while you're checking out jessesublett.com to find out when his EP is coming out and to get this book, 1960s Austin Gangsters, don't forget that you can like our Facebook page. Get over there and like it. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes. You can favorite us on Stitcher if you're on that program, so you can just stream podcasts, over 5,000 shows on there. Everything you want to hear, including How Did I Get Here? Always a good time. I use it. I do. I seriously do. Anyway, so like our Facebook page and do all that stuff. Get over there and like Jesse's Facebook page. Pick up his book. Read it. Let's hear some more music from his upcoming EP. All right. This is more music from Jesse Sublett. Thank you, Jesse. Thank you guys for listening. I hope that you have a great, great, great day, whatever you're doing. Jogging, faking work, pretending to be working, right? Or maybe you're working and listening to it. Or maybe you're driving somewhere. Maybe you're in a band and you're on your way to a gig. Hey, guys, break a leg tonight. Okay, here's some more music from Jesse Sublett. Let's get down.
That's what Mama said. Just the thought of that precious boy brought a smile to Mama's face. Her boy grew up and marched off to war. It was hard time when he came home. All they had to put in the ground was a handful of bones, stones in the coffin, nothing left to bury. It was stones in the coffin. May 1953, sky of a Waco grew a sickly green. It was a funnel cloud coming, the blackest they ever did see. In the teeth of that storm, that angry wind tossed cows into the clouds. Shankers flying free as birds in the wing, and houses turned inside out. It was stones in the coffin. It was nothing left to bury. It was stones in the coffin. Every Sunday, Mama hollers out, ain't no reason, all right. Flowers don't bloom and the garden is a graveyard. Why'd I have to take that boy of mine? Seasons change, things don't get no better. Memories don't fade and wounds don't close. And what? Flying the flag over an empty hole. And why, oh why, oh why, why'd they have to take that boy of mine? It was stones in the coffin when they put it in the ground. It was nothing left to bury. family gather round. It was stones in the coffin. Make up my nightmare. It was done.